Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening. Hello, everyone. This is Annie Marges, and I'm here on SCAN Radio, Stop Child Abuse Now, SCAN, and this is radio show 3039. SCAN Radio is brought to you by NASCA. NASCA is the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. NASCA is a nonprofit 501c3. And I'm going to read NASCA's mission statement. And this is coming from their website, which is NASCA.org. That's NASCA.org. Mission statement. We have but a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, CSA. Presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. Two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And tonight I am joined here on the show by Kim, she's the co-host with me, and by Monica, who is our guest host. And I am going to read Monica's bio to you. Let's see. Tonight's special guest is Monica Boglund from Pulliup, Washington, a survivor of sexual, physical, and emotional child abuse. Her predators were all family members, and her parents were intent on passing on to Monica the behavior that their parents had done to them. She has also lived with lupus since she was 29, a painful autoimmune disease that has long been linked to adverse childhood experiences, ACEs. Monica became a life coach and a therapist and notes, "I've finally found a way to forgive the unforgivable and to firmly keep anyone and everything harmful out of my life." She's earned her master's degree in metaphysical science and counseling and is well on her way to earning a PhD in the same field. I hope to further use my story as a way to become of service and to help those along the path to their own healing, because I now know that hope and help is available. On these scan episodes, we welcome various co-hosts, survivor professionals who assist in fielding questions and lead a variety of topics suggested by our call-in participants. Their trauma-informed perspectives as survivor professionals help them guide discussions on the issues of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality that spring from questions and topics brought to us by our listeners. Everyone's invited to engage on tonight's show. And the phone number to call to be on the show is area code 646-595-2118. I'll repeat that, 646-595-2118. And Kim will greet you and will get you on the air and get you asking your questions or making your comments. And so now, Miss Monica Buck.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me on. I wanted today's topic tonight that I wanted to speak on narcissistic parenting or narcissistic parents in general. I'm hoping by us approaching the abuse that we've all survived and endured that we can, at least in my sense, what has helped me in my healing and my growth. Part of my professional background as a teacher and most recently studying behavior therapy is to understand personalities, one, and then actual behaviors separately. So if we are able to put ourselves in a position where we can objectively identify and classify what some of the behaviors and personality traits are, it can better help us begin to distance ourselves from the emotional connection that we may still have with the abusers in our life. And we can, not for the sake of forgiveness, because that is totally up to you, but for the sake of finally putting your mind at ease that the abuse that we endured had absolutely nothing to do with us, and to look at it from a more objective point of view, which has helped me greatly. I can, in my study and observation over the years, I can now clearly look back in my childhood during my years of being molested by my brother, being physically abused by my father, and emotionally abused by my mother. I can now clearly look back at the environment that I was raised in where a family had absolutely no clue of living healthy and free of toxic and negative behaviors. They just did not have the resources, did not have the education, and flat out did not have the support of their own to do things differently. They themselves, as Annie said in my bio, they themselves at some point made a choice that the behaviors that they exhibited to me as a sister or a daughter symptomatic of the behaviors that they had in themselves. Forgiveness is totally up to you. So at some point as an adult, you're aware of the things that have happened to you in your own childhood, and you do have a chance or an opportunity to make a different choice with how you're going to behave towards your own children. I was just raised in an environment where they chose not to do that. Does it make it right? No. Does it mean that I'm in a forgiving state of mind with them? No. Does it mean that I still clearly hold the abuse that I endured and the disappointment and the anger and the hatred that I felt for being a victim of that? Do I hold that close to my chest now at 49 years old? Absolutely not. I've been graced with being able to be placed in professional environments and luckily in personal environments as well, where I can see people living their lives differently and living it in a healthy way in order to get the results that they felt that they needed And the only way that a toxic person can get the results that they need is they don't feel that they can do things in a different way because they themselves haven't been exposed to anything other than negativity. So starting with that, I want to read out, I'm going to get started on 5 traits from an article that I found on Apple News. And this site is by Well and Good. So if you follow Apple News, please find the Well and Good link. And the article is titled, 5 Signs in Adulthood That You're a Child of a Narcissistic Parent and How to Heal. Power article by several psychologists. So again, with that, I want to find my sources. So I'm now going to also double back to a great definition that I found online by the Mayo Clinic. And the Mayo Clinic has a very clear definition on what narcissistic personality disorder is. So reading that definition, narcissistic personality disorders, one of several types of personality disorders, is a mental condition in which people have an inflated sense of their own importance, a deep need for excessive attention and admiration. They also are involved in troubled relationships and have a lack of empathy for others. But behind this mask of extreme confidence lies a fragile self-esteem that's vulnerable to the slightest criticism. So if we can individually take that definition and apply it to the personality of at least one abuser in any of our lifetime, basically the crux of it is saying, as this is a very hurt, broken person who probably has never had the chance to develop their own strong positive sense of self, self-value, or self-love. So in order to feel admired, which people often attribute that to love, in order to feel admiration and feel that people are admiring them, they have to resort to the one thing that they know will get a response from people. And sometimes that thing that they resort to happens to be abuse. There's also another doctor I would caution all of you to follow. She has a great channel on YouTube. Her name is Dr. Ramani, R-A-M-A-N-I. She is a clinically and board certified psychologist.
She's awesome. I follow her.
She's awesome. She's done several talks on the Red Table Talk on Facebook Watch with Jada Pinkett Show, the Red Table Talk, and I started following her, and again, you start hearing seeing the aha moments, and the check marks start hitting off. But she made a really good point on one recent show that she did with them about narcissism. So narcissism, again, in the worst-case scenario, narcissism can lead to a sociopath personality or sociopathy. Sociopathy then could also lead further down the path of a psychopath. The difference, from what I know, is the clear difference between sociopaths and psychopaths. They both have a lack of empathy, which means whatever they do to other people, they have absolutely no regard of how it affects that person. The difference in sociopathy, when negative things happen, sociopathy is a socialized behavior, which means you learn to treat people bad and you learn to treat them negative. And you may feel guilty or you feel bad about the bad behavior after the fact once you see how it's affecting the person, right? Which is why we dealt with a lot of abusers. And in my instance growing up with my father, I would see my mother get physically abused, but then he would go out and buy her a new bracelet, or he would buy her flowers, or he would take the family on trips. That was his way of trying to ease his conscience about the abuse that he rendered upon us. Once he saw us in tears and huddled up in corners and fearing for our lives. So it's a learned behavior. The difference in that and a psychopath would be your Jeffrey Dahmers of the world. they are physically born absent of a functioning amygdala, which is a part of the brain that regulates emotion. So it is either malformed, disformed, or it is physically actually absent in the brain. And so any action that they take, good, bad, great, negative, indifferent, abusing, or even to the level of murdering people, it never registers in their brain that they are doing something bad to someone else. So what Dr. Romney said clearly, narcissists can be sociopaths and psychopaths, right? But a psychopath does not necessarily need to have narcissistic traits. So it can work one way and doesn't necessarily work the other way. So I hope that kind of clarifies a little bit on where narcissism lies in the brain with people, and whether it be a mother, a father, a brother, a sister, an uncle, a grandparent, I caution everyone listening to begin to do your own self-work on your growth and your healing, and begin to look less at these people through the emotional attachment that we have with them or the family attachment we have with them, and start to look at their behavior. We are not trying to fix them. We are not trying to teach them how to do things differently, because you will never heal as long as you are in constant communication with them. So it's not up to us to change them. But we can begin to understand the behavior, so we can now be better equipped when new behavior comes into our life and it could potentially be abusive on a different level. We can now firmly say no about that behavior, draw a line in the sand, and you know clearly where the negative behavior is going to end up. And you can now begin to guard yourself against other narcissistic, potentially abusive people from coming into your life and wreaking havoc. Because if you don't do that, and again, you have not exposed yourself to other positive environments in your life, it is only by nature that you will continue to involve yourself in the only habits, behaviors, personalities that you are accustomed to. So it's up to you to change and grow, and not necessarily focus on the change and growth of our abusers. So I hope that makes sense for everyone before we get started on what these personality traits and behaviors look like.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you. I apologize for my dog being unhappy. And so I'm going to turn it over to Kim. Kim, would you like to respond to Monica?
Oh, no, Monica, just thank you so much for, you know, coming in and bringing this to people's attention, because a lot of people don't understand this. And I think, you know, I think that I probably, as you have explained, I too have a pretty common narcissistic parent story where you know, it was always about them and not about the children even ever. It was about, you know, their drugs and what they needed and what they wanted. And so I was just kind of the aftermath in that. But I love Dr. Romney, for one. She's one of my favorite people to listen to. But now I'm like right in the, I'm separated from my husband of 32 years. And he is a very, I think that's how I figured out that my parents were narcissists, is by figuring out that he was, because he just has no compassion for me ever, any kind of passion or compassion ever. And even when I'm, you know, sick, especially, and this has been a pattern in our relationship where I need to have a surgery or something, and he's physically there, but he's not really there, you know. He just does things very passive-aggressively and very, you know, covertly, so that people don't understand exactly what he is doing, like throwing a plate at my feet, making it shatter all over.
I call it for people that don't understand the literal sense of cutting people out of your life. People can say that all day, but they don't actually physically do it, or they don't have the functionality of how to do it. I call it emotional surgery.
Yeah.
So if you can get into any other area of your life and say you have one bad kidney and you got to get rid of that kidney, you can function with one kidney, you got to go to the doctor and have surgery to get that kidney removed. If you got to go and get your, I don't know, you got a bad pancreas, your pancreas has got to be removed. You got to go to surgery, see the doctor, and have surgery. So for us, we got to be literal and physical about where our emotions lie. And once you emotionally have that emotional surgery done and literally cut people out of your life, you will feel such a burden lifted from your life. Now you can see things a little clearer. You can see things a little happier. And you will be more than willing to start on the journey of healing and being happy. But it will never happen as long as you keep the bad person in your life, because all they're going to do is to continue to do what they know how to do, and that is bad behavior. And in this instance, we're speaking on narcissism.
I mean, I agree with you. You know what? We have Darlene on the phone. She's calling in, and I was wondering if you would mind if we see if she has a question. We'll bring her on.
Darlene. Hello.
Hey.
How are you? I just now called in. I'm a little late because I went to dinner, and so I'm a little late, but I love this discussion about hearing about the personality traits of a narcissist?
Yeah. It's a good subject.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, so what this article is about that I've researched is it's going to give us survivors of a narcissistic parent. It's going to start to give us clues in our current behavior and why we behave the way we do because of a narcissistic parent, if that makes sense. So I want to start off on one of the first points that the article makes here. And again, the article is from Well and Good on Apple News. And again, I mentioned the name of the article again at the end of the talk. So we're going to talk about five behavioral signs that you grew up with a narcissistic parent. One sign is, and we spoke clearly, and if you remember last month, on last month's topic, so we were talking more about toxic people. But specifically to this month's topic, I wanted to hone in on narcissism so we can all kind of get a clear view of that. So the first behavioral sign here says that you are a people pleaser to a fault, or you find yourself constantly in a caretaker role. That's one behavior. Familiarity with trying to please a difficult parent. A child of a narcissist may later choose to date or even marry a narcissist because the role of taking care of another person's needs before their own is what is familiar for them. So that is case in point of what you just said, Pam, about your ex-husband, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, perfect. And that's what I've been.
So
I've been trying.
We people please. So last month I brought up the topic on what people do actually in response to trauma. And so the response is that most people are familiar with, we call it fight or flight. And in a clinical sense, there are a total of four responses to trauma: fight, flight, freeze, because we don't know what to do. The fourth one is called fawning, WNIN, which means you're in the people pleasing category. I'm so enamored. I don't know what to do. I just want the abuse to stop. I'm going to do everything to make this person like or love me. That puts you in the people-pleasing position. You're just trying to get the abuse to stop at that moment because, again, the child in us never developed a clear sense of independent self in a positive way because a narcissistic person does not have the desire to do that or the ability to do it. So when we are busy people-pleasing, we just want the abuse to stop right then in that moment. So if I can cook better, clean better, have sex better as a kid with my parents, I can play better sports, I can clean my room better, I can get better grades, I can do everything I can do to keep my parents from physically abusing me. I can do everything to keep my mother from emotionally putting me down and telling me she wished I was never born and she hated I was born and she didn't like me and things of that nature. When we get into the people-pleasing mentality, you start putting other people's needs before your own, and before you know it, that becomes your existence. You don't exist because the needs of yourself don't matter. The needs of the other people matter, and so your existence is only of value according to how the other person responds to you with love or admiration, even though they're within you, and they would never freely give you that because they don't have the ability to do it. But as a people pleaser, you fall into that category because we don't know what else to do as a response to that trauma. And in this instance, a response to the narcissistic parent. And until you develop a sense of self, we all go through the phase where people tell us as adults where you're no longer a kid, you just have to grow up. No one really tells you how to grow up, right? They just say you're not in high school, you may go to college, you may get a job, get married and have kids, and you're doing it the same way other people are doing it. So no one really breaks down the emotional or psychological turmoil that it takes for you to do it in a healthy way. So unfortunately, we just continue to do the same behaviors that we've only been accustomed to. That means being a child of a narcissist, more than likely to have a relationship or marry a narcissist. And in the worst case scenario, become a narcissist yourself. So does anyone have anything they want to chime in on that point?
I want to say thank you, Monica. This is Annie. I wanted to comment on that one passage that you went through about, you know, you can do everything better. You can be a better student and a better cleaning the house and cleaning up your room and do everything better so they won't abuse me. But it didn't work.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that well. And so that's why I'm people pleaser. See, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that those tied together that way. So thank
exactly.
you. That's all I have to say.
How about our caller? How does that fit with you?
Yeah, hold on. Let's see. Darlene. Okay, Darlene, I muted you. You're here. Did you have something to say?
Yeah. I don't have that much to say right now. I'm just really tired right now.
Oh, are you? You just listening in? You just want me to... How about you?
I'm just really tired right now, so I'm just listening in. I might have something to say shortly.
Okay. We'll keep checking in with you then.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I definitely have been... I have been accused of being a narcissist by my daughter, by my oldest daughter. And when she said that to me, I went, no, that's what I've been dealing with my whole life. And I'm just like, so, I mean, I could understand where I'm at a point in my life where you know, my daughter, my kids are all grown. She's 35 years old, the one that gives me the hardest time. And she, I mean, she mostly just sticks up for her father all the time, but he's the one that always gave them the money, you know, he was the money
right.
person. And I just wanted to be, when we got married, I just wanted to be the stay-at-home mom and wife and, you know, take care of everybody. And that's what I wanted to do. And because I didn't have that growing up, I had the narcissistic parents that, and they worked, but when they weren't working, they were high or, you know, on
right.
heroin, I guess, or whatever they were doing.
I call it functioning abusers. You know, we've heard
yes.
of the term functioning addict and
yeah.
functioning alcoholic.
Oh, yeah. Functioning abuser. Oh, yeah. Most definitely.
Because
my mom was
for
the city judge.
In one big bowl, they both abused me, so they were functioning abusers. They can function in
Absolutely.
The world and go out and get a job and do what they need on their job to be a provider and pay their bills. In the home, it was the abuse.
It was, yeah, or neglect or whatever. Yeah.
Right, right.
And I think I was the one that was most available and around because I was the oldest. Basically. But what really surprised me is that, and then my stepdad, who had raised me, he's the only dad I've pretty much known, sexually abused me as well when I was 12. And then when I told my mom at 15 what had happened, because my dad had stopped because he was adopting us at the same time, about the same time that he decided to do that. And then I said something to the judge about I still wanted him. I want him to be my dad, and so I guess that made him feel like he needed to stop. Duh. But I heard that.
And let me put this out there: he didn't stop because he knew it was wrong, or didn't stop because
right.
he was aware that he was hurting you. He stopped only because he was afraid of getting caught because of the legal situation. So he knew what the repercussions legally could mean if he was found to have been sexually abusing you. That was the only reason he stopped.
Right.
That is another thing where we can make the distinction between a sociopath and a psychopath. They both are narcissistic uh-huh. because they have no compassion for others, but they are able to yeah. control the behavior in one sense and is uncontrollable in the other sense, right? So in the sense of my father being physically abusive to my mother and us as my siblings, he was never sexually abusive to me, but physically. But we could go out on vacation and we could be the picture-perfect family, and my father never laid a hand on us. But before or after that family vacation, we got our asses kicked up one side of the house and down the other. But because yeah. he knew an audience or a platform or people could see him and see the crack that he wasn't this perfect family man, he didn't abuse
yeah.
us to where other people would notice, because then he would get caught, or as the article said,
right.
the mask would come off. So that's the only
yeah.
reason that abuse stopped on your father's end, because he knew that he would face severe penalty in a legal sense.
Right, which is sad. And but I don't think that my ex-husband, he still doesn't believe that he's done anything wrong, because he had, you know, on the outside, he had provided for his family. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, any question, if I asked him, you know, hey, I need more affection. Oh, I got to work. You know, I got to pay some bills. I got to do this and I got to do that to help everybody else. Mary, you know, it's just like, okay, never mind. I don't want a hug. Forget it.
You know what?
So I
try to look at things in my training now in the world of metaphysics. It is a good amalgamation of religion and philosophy and a little bit of psychology thrown in there. And so, again, it was just one of those things I was pushed into that. It was a calling for me, but it has also been the best self-help tool that I can be to move myself now further into becoming a counselor and hopeful author. But I've never been married.
Sure.
But when I look back at these so-called sacred vows that people take, whether you're at a courthouse mm-hmm. or you're in a church in front of your family members, I tell people we can believe so much in religion, But where in the religion does it actually say in those vows that we will love each other and be together for better or worse, or till death do us part? So where in those vows does it say, I can only love you or be married to you if I'm happy and healthy and whole, and in order to do that, you must not abuse me or hit me or put me down or rape me or molest me? Where are those vows?
Yeah.
So as human beings, we do a lot of masking. We just get married and fall for the fantasy of what being married is, or have the children and the fantasy of what being the mother is. That a medical and psychological information has been available to the masses because of social media and the internet. Guess what? When I do my research, I research books that are 50, 60, 75 years old by clinical authors and clinicians. The information has always been there. We have just not been exposed to it, which goes again to what I say, that abuse is a learned behavior. And if you can learn it, you can unlearn it. And that is a part what I hope that everyone can take from their calls with NASCA on how to heal. Because you may not be able to change your abuser, and it is not your responsibility to do so. You have to change you and begin to value yourself and love yourself more, and begin to set clear boundaries in your life about behaviors and actions and words that you will accept or tolerate from positive or negative people. Be firm in your no's. Be very open to your yeses, but be very firm in your no's. And when you say no, it needs to be a clear no with even clearer consequences. So you don't get to be a boyfriend or a husband in my life, and you say or do something abusive and continue to receive my attention and love after the abuse. But I have to be clear in my no when I say no, that behavior is not acceptable. And if you continue to do it, this is the consequence. I will leave you. I will divorce you. I don't have to be in contact with you. And, of course, do it in a safe manner to where you can protect yourself, to be very clear on what we're looking at when we're looking at behaviors, because certain people do not have the on and off switch in their behavior, which is what makes them the psychopath. In the instance that we have domestic violence situations where children are being chained in basements, and women are being raped by their husbands, and women and children are being abused and sexually molested by parents, because we don't have a clear sense of boundaries and what the boundaries are outside of that relationship. So I want to support everyone in understanding, again, we can't change the abusers. We have to work on changing ourselves.
Thank you, Monica. This is Annie. And you know what jumped at me in your speaking was the part about boundaries, that we have to have boundaries. And I kind of know now what boundaries are, but I remember being the person thinking, I don't know what you're talking about. What do they mean? What's a boundary? And I think I would appreciate an explanation of boundaries, and there's probably other people listening who would as well.
Yeah. Well, let's just say that if we can break down boundaries, and again, we're talking about things that, for one, are in the emotional sense, and then two, they're eventually going to manifest itself in the physical sense when we're talking about abuse. So a boundary could mean, first, we don't know, because we haven't been taught on how to set a boundary and why we need to set a boundary. So if we are at the beach and we are want to do a great bonfire, right? Everyone knows they're going to dig a hole and you scoop out the sand. So you're going to put the wood and everything into the hole, and make the fire. For one, the hole has to contain the fire and hold the firewood. But if people don't realize what they do secondarily, you may take pieces of rock and put it around the hole before you light the fire. That means you're trying to contain the fire in the hole so it doesn't spread out and scatter along the beach and no one gets hurt or burned. So think of the rocks around the fire pit as your boundary. Think of you being the firewood. Fire does not necessarily mean something bad in most senses. We need fire to cook, right? We got to light a stove or turn on an electric oven. We need something of fire to heat our hot water tank when we want to take a nice hot bath. Something fiery doesn't mean anything bad. When it's uncontained and it gets out of hand and a fire grows and it needs more oxygen and then a fire becomes a forest fire or a fire that burns down your house because it's uncontained and you can't control it. So does that make sense? In our emotional self, we are trying to protect ourselves on the emotional level from abuse, on the physical level from abuse, on any other level where something is not going to be good and positive. We have to set a boundary, and that boundary for any people, person, place, thing that we interact with, the boundary has to be set. Whether you clearly state it, you do it in your words, you do it in your actions, but a person needs to know that this is a boundary for you and I am not allowed to cross it without hurting my friend, hurting my wife, hurting my child, right? I'm not allowed to cross it because if I do, then these are going to be the consequences as a result of me crossing the boundary. So we are not taught as children to create boundaries because when a child tells a parent no, as any child will say that, in their space they know that, no, I don't want to eat the extra plate of peas. No, I don't want to put the shoes on because they're hurting my feet, because the child doesn't know that their feet are growing. And so the size 4 shoe that they wore now doesn't fit a size 5 shoe, and the mother hasn't bothered to figure out that their child physically is growing and the shoes are too small and uncomfortable. But the child says, no, my feet hurt, these shoes hurt. But we do not empower children to say that it is okay for them to set a boundary, because them saying the no to the parent, only in the narcissistic parent's head, the parent sees it as defiance. And how dare you tell me as your parent what to do? I'm the authority, not you as the child. You stay in a child's place. You do what I tell you to do. You get belittled. You get pushed down. Your voice gets diminished. So when that happens from childhood to adolescence to adulthood, and no one is telling you it is okay to set boundaries because you're doing it as a way to protect yourself and keep yourself in a positive comfort zone, we then become adults who don't know how to set boundaries. And then we then follow the same patternistic behavior by narcissistic, toxic, abusive traits and personalities in our own personal circles as adults, because we never learned what boundaries were, what they're meant for, and why it is a clearly healthy engagement in setting boundaries. It all goes back to the environment we were born in and raised in. And so boundaries have to be there for a reason at any point in time in our lives. And again, the information is not just readily available when you're born into the world. You may, unless you're looking for it. So people now, psychologists say, listen to your child when they say no. Have the conversation if a child is saying no. Why is the child saying no? It doesn't mean that they're just automatically being defiant. Maybe they don't have the vocabulary yet or the wherewithal yet to say what the no means and why no was their response to something. They just clearly know the difference between yes or no. It means you get something, no means you don't get something. That's a knee-jerk reaction. So some of us clearly have just not been allowed to grow again into our own emotional independence from childhood to young adulthood, and then we become independent adults on our own, clearly not knowing how to set boundaries and why boundaries are beneficial.
Yes, that happened to me. Yes. Yes, it did. Thank you. And that certainly happened to me. I didn't learn how to set them. And then I, throughout my life, I've had people take advantage of me in ways that maybe if I'd had some boundaries, it wouldn't have happened. But I was never really clear on how to make one. How do you make a boundary? And how do you keep it?
I think we all have got to understand that if you set the boundary and the people in your life that don't respect the boundary, we have got to be ready for the consequences. Whatever behavior happens, there's always going to be a consequence, either the behavior by the person or the behavior by us. And if the behavior is, I set the boundary and someone clearly didn't respect my boundaries, I've got to be ready if my consequence for disrespecting the boundary is I no longer need you as my best friend because you don't respect my boundaries. I've got to be ready at some point to stop calling that friend, stop inviting her to dinner, stop calling her, stop texting her, stop. I have got to be clear in my no, which is the boundary. And there are no further anything that you receive from me, because at this point they could clearly be narcissists and they don't care whether a response from you is positive or negative as long as you're giving them some type of attention. So that's what the definition of narcissistic said, right? They need constant attention and admiration. It didn't say positive or negative attention. But as long as they're getting some response from you, they're going to continue to do certain behavior as long as we allow them in. So they can get no response from me if I no longer communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I want to get on to the next point. I'm looking at the time, and I know this topic is going to be a hot, touchy topic, but we want to try to get through all the points before we get wrapped up today. So point number two says, you regularly doubt yourself and your reality. In failing to give credence to the kid's emotions, a narcissistic parent also often dismisses the child's very understanding of their reality. They may have told you that certain things that happened didn't actually happen. So that could be a case in point of you having a memory of the parent putting you down or disregarding you on actual case of the abuse, the molestation, the physical abuse, the emotional abuse. You can actually have a clear reality of that. And the narcissist, again, if you're not strong enough in your sense of self-value, the narcissist will clearly tell you, but that didn't happen. I don't remember it like that. You must have remembered something wrong. Or worst case in point, they flat out tell you that you're lying. And Dr. Romani, when she's addressing narcissistic personality disorder, in a nutshell, we call that type of behavior by the narcissist gaslighting. They are trying to distort your sense of reality. Because remember, when you're telling the narcissist that they did something bad to you or they're doing something bad to people, they need to be admired at all times. And so they're going to tell you that the way you remember things is crazy. It didn't happen that way. No one believes you. So they diminish your sense of reality. And that is gaslighting. That is another trait that we deal with that we are now moving through life as adults and we are unsure or insecure of our own reality. How does that point hit home with anyone?
Yep, for sure. It hits home with me. Yeah, I know. Everything that you say, I just relate to. So, but thank you for this, because there's probably are people out there that haven't ever heard about this, or they're doing the aha thing right now, going, oh,
exactly.
My gosh.
They're getting what I call the light bulb moment, you know, the aha moment. And it's like, aha, now this makes sense.
Ah, right. But now it does make it more complicated when you almost have to see that person periodically. I mean, I try to make it as minimal as possible, but I do have 3 grown kids with him and then 6 grandkids. And so it's like there are just times, kids' parties or something like that, that it comes up. And he is at the point now where he's like, I'm just going to let you do whatever. But he still does the passive-aggressive things on the side. Like our anniversary was just pretty soon. And he knew I wasn't going to be at the house, but he knew my daughter would be at the house that day. And so he left a card for me on the table. I'm like, if you wanted to get that card to me, you would have gotten it to me, not be passive aggressive and just leave it there. Oh, I got this for your mom. Because then my daughter is on the other end going, because they don't know, you know, they don't want to get in the middle of it. But he almost puts them in the middle of it by doing that passive aggressive stuff. Because then she's like, well, at least you got you a card. I'm like, no, it's not at least you got me a card yet. You know, it's a million other things that he did before that, like not fixed my wedding ring for 20 years. There was a point where I really, really wanted that done. And so it was hurtful that he wouldn't fix it for me. And, but, you know, he got me a card for our anniversary after I left him. So I guess everything should just be all hunky-dory, right?
Well, I can say that it sounds like he thought that the MO of what he had while you guys were together, he thought it was the same MO to get the response from you after you left. So regardless of all of the negativity that prompted your divorce, well, I'll just buy her a present, and that's going to get me a good response from her, because that's probably what has been happening in your previous years before you finally make the decision to leave. So he had developed no other sense of how to interact with you, regardless of his behavior. It was a knee-jerk reaction, but I always buy her a present or buy her a card on her birthday or Mother's Day, and then everything is all good. So he just did it as a knee-jerk reaction, actually any compassion or empathy or him making amends and wanted to fix your relationship.
Oh, no. As a matter of fact, the reasons why I told him I was leaving, he was using against me as well. You know, I'm like, these are the reasons I'm leaving. Oh, well, you just don't like me for this, and you don't like this about me. And I'm just like, oh, my gosh. You don't even try. But I know in my mind, because I've been, you know, doing this for a while too, going trying to figure it out, that there isn't any way. He's just not going to change. And as much as I could think, okay, if he went to counseling, because I told him if he got a counselor, I would talk to him, but I'm not going to talk to him without a counselor, his own and my own.
And that is a boundary for you. Kudos to you for setting the boundary. And the consequence was, the boundary is get counseling. The consequence doesn't have to be negative or positive. It just means the thing that happens after the behavior shows up. So your consequence was, potentially, we could talk to each other or maybe work things out, which would be the positive thing, which would be the end result. But that's only if he got counseling. And again, if he, true to form like a narcissist, distorted the reality and for some reason made you think and the other family members think he doesn't need counseling, he's not the problem, you are. So why would he commit to counseling if he's not ready to be unveiled. He's not ready to take the mask off.
Right. Exactly. He has never been. But because I've always been the one that's gone to counseling because of my childhood. So, you know, I'm trying to better myself, and he's using it against me. And so it's just typical. It's just the typical, which is sad, you know, because I think anybody who wants their marriage to work spends a long time hoping and praying and, you know, everything just that they'll
a
change.
Healthy person.
They can change.
I do believe that words are tools. They don't necessarily have to be weapons. They can be weapons in
right.
the hand of the wrong person. They can be weaponed used by a narcissist or an abusive person. But the same words can be used as tools. Just as you can use a tool to build something up, you can use a tool to tear something down. So you committing to therapy meant you use that as a tool because the healthy part of your brain wants to get answers and it wants to get help. He knows that counseling is available, but he didn't want to commit to it. So I'll interject there. At one point years ago, I had to go through a domestic violence situation at the end of a bad breakup with a boyfriend. And I had court-ordered anger management classes to go through because of this bad physical fight with the boyfriend that I had. It was the first inkling to me on what counseling was and how beneficial it was to me. And through this weekly eight-week classes that I had to take, the counselor probably on week three finally kind of gave me a little emotional shake of the shoulders. Like, Monica, wake up. These relationships, you're choosing the relationship. You're choosing negative men. You're choosing bad men. Because you had a negative father. You had a bad father. You're trying to fix what happened with your father in your new relationship with the men that you choose. So we first got to get a sense of why you're choosing the men that you choose, and they have the same behaviors and personalities that your father had. And I could clearly explain to her how physically abusive my father was, but I was not yet aware of the birth of that type of abuse started emotionally. And because I had no other experience with positive figures in my life, Iyanla Van Zandt says all the time in her speeches and in her workshops that women marry their fathers. And men marry their mothers, which means it is the first bonding experience of a personality or a behavior that we have, that we fundamentally, women bond with their fathers as protectors, men bond with their mothers as nurturers. So when you were looking for a husband and I was looking for a boyfriend as a protector, I only knew and could relate to the negative, toxic, narcissistic personality that I experienced from my father because I had no... I approached my father one year about counseling once I understood why I was attracted to abusive relationships and abusive men. I called my father clearly and said, this has got to start with you because if you were head of the family, you were the protector and the provider. I saw you abusing my mother. You abused us as children. I want to know why you did it. And if you want to better your relationship with me, you need to understand why you did it. My understanding is that his father, my grandfather, was abusive to him as children. But as a grandfather, to me, he was a saint. So let's sit with the counselor and figure it out because we're not able to have the communications ourselves. We don't have the language. We don't have the science. My father agreed to the counseling. I was living out of the city, still in the same state but in a different city. So I made an effort to schedule the counseling in a city he lived in. So I went back home, and on the day of the counseling, about 3 hours before the appointment. I called him to remind him of the appointment. My father was fully retired at that point, so nothing that he had to do. Mind you, he had agreed to do it about 2 or 3 weeks before. The morning of the appointment, I don't show up. I said, what do you mean you're not coming? It's already scheduled. I paid for the session. I'm just not coming. It was at that point my heart sank because he didn't say it in an argumentative way. He didn't say it in any other abusive way as far as he would like to get an argument to validate his point. Well, I'm not going to do this because you started an argument with me the other day. That day, it was just clearly, I'm not going. I don't need to show up for that. The check mark went in my head then, and it stayed there permanently, and it's been over 10 years ago. My father and the words that I was able to get out to him that day are a complete and utter disappointment to me as a father. You are living your life as a complete and utter disappointment as a man. This is why you can never be loved fully by the people in your life that you want to love you. Because where it matters, you are not available. And you don't care what happens to me and how your behavior and inactions now hurt me by not showing up to something that can help me. You simply don't care enough to show up. So thank you for once again showing me that you are not a man who knows how to love me as your daughter. So you, in my life now, I caution anyone, the best thing that has, again, begin to put distance between me and the abusers, I no longer address them as my parents. Them by their first name, George and Lola. I do not address them as my mother or father. I haven't addressed them as mother or father in close to 10 years. I speak to them even less infrequently now, about every 2 to 3 years. I didn't call them through the whole pandemic. I waited till the pandemic was over. I have other family members that I love and adore and check on them, and I knew that they weren't sick. I knew that no one was in the hospital. So earlier this year, I placed a phone call and cut it till about 10 minutes. Okay, you guys are fine. You're safe. No sickness, blah, 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 blah. But they wanted to talk about the weather and where I live and this, that, and the other, and you are still not helpful. You still will not commit to counseling. You are still not addressing the abuse issues. So have a good day, and maybe I'll talk to you again in 3 years if somebody doesn't die first. So we have to begin to physically put distance and emotionally put distance between us. Because my father at that point realized he could no longer be admired and exalted, because he would then be faced with a clinical psychologist or a counselor that could then call him out on his abuse. So why would he show up to a counseling session, even if you have a daughter who has lupus, and my lupus is now a result of ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, because my body and my immune system never fully healed and developed because of the constant stress I was under from the threats of abuse. Why would my father show up to something that was helpful to his own daughter? Because it would mean he would have to remove the mask, and he could no longer be put on the pedestal as being the good family man and the provider that had a good job and took his parents on vacation. So how could I possibly be a bad person? So narcissists have a very clear way of manipulating their way through life. And at the end of the day, whatever they choose to do is only going to be beneficial to them. It would never be beneficial or helpful to us, even though there is clear negative abuse or toxic results as a reason behind their actions. They will never do it. For one, the desire is not there. And for two, if we're clinically talking about the sociopathy or psychopathy, they clinically don't have the ability to do it. As long as everyone admires them and thinks that they're a good person. So the abusers have the ability to be a terrible husband to you, and in Annie's case, a terrible father to them. In my case, a terrible father to me. But they can appear to be a really good worker at their job. They can appear to be a good deacon in the church. They can appear to be a good family man taking their kids on vacation and buying presents every Christmas. They are totally absorbed with the appearance of being a good person instead of doing the work that it takes to actually be a good person. And again, their behavior has nothing to do with us. It's all about them and how they were raised and what they were exposed to, because in order to get healed, you have to admit that the hurt exists. You can get a scratch on your skin today, and in order for the scratch to heal, it has to scab up. Right? People have and people will automatically put on a Band-Aid, but most people will tell you, take the Band-Aid off and let the skin heal. It'll get a scab, and then the scab flakes away, and then the scratch will be all healed up. People automatically want to put on the Band-Aid and cover up the problem as if it never existed, because they don't have the tools to actually go through what we call the healing process, because it exposes them too much. All right, let's take a look at point three. Point three here says that you're often on the hunt for external validation. A child of narcissists learns at a young age that their own worth is intrinsically tied up in how much they can satisfy others. This kind of sort of goes back to people-pleasing, right? So later in life, they can find themselves dead set on receiving validation from others that they're, in fact, serving them in some positive way. Children of narcissists can often hear their parents' overly critical voice in their head, like a recording that won't go off. Dr. Romney has made a point, and several other clinicians have made a point. They refer to this as negative self-talk. But it doesn't actually start with you. It is actually the hauntingly critical voice of your parent that at whatever age they begin to do it, telling you that you were constantly worthless. You're not going to be anything. You don't matter. No one is going to love you, regardless of how well you do this or the things that you accomplish or how well you dress or how pretty you are. None of that matters. But you go out and you try to get the best job and you buy the best car and you try to buy the best clothes. And a lot of our young women nowadays, they're getting the breast augmentations and the butt augmentations, and 20-year-old women are getting facelifts and getting all of the fat sucked out of their body because they have to be deemed beautiful and pretty by an outside standard. Because in their head, the negative self-talk tells them they're not worthy, they're not beautiful, they're ugly, they are not going to accomplish this, or the person is not going to love them unless they go outside of themselves to do these other sets of things in order to be validated. So point three, as adults, we're constantly seeking external validation. And if any of us could look back in our own lives, we can also look back at some point in time in our lives that we have experienced or engaged in external validation. And for me, it showed up as being a workaholic. It showed up first in my youth as being great at sports, volleyball, softball, everything that I can do to show that I was a really good person because my father loved sports. And that was the only time he showed up, at events at school for me, if it was a sporting event, because my older brother played football. And he'd show up at the game for my brother, again, showing up with the perception that he's the good father. So when I got old enough to play sports, I decided to play sports because that's how my father gave us positive attention. So when I became a young woman in the working world, that same father that gave me attention in high school for being good at sports is the same father that would not sign off on my scholarship paperwork at age 17, where I could go just an hour away from my home within the same state and attend college on a volleyball scholarship. He would not sign my paperwork because I was underage at 17 when I graduated high school, and I needed their signature. And he completely destroyed, the first time that I remember him destroying one of my dreams, that I could not play college-level volleyball because he would not allow me to move away from home. So I enrolled in the first program that I thought was going to get me a job and get me out of my parents' house as quickly as I could. I became a licensed cosmetologist. And at 18 years old, I graduated my program. And with, at the age of 19, I moved out of my parents' home and into my first apartment without their help, without their assistance. Bought furniture, had a friend to help me co-sign for the apartment. I'm being independent, and I'm out in the world, and I got the hell away from them. But I was also a workaholic. I worked from sunup to sundown. It wasn't about making money at this point when I look back on it. I needed people when I was getting admiration and people telling me you did a good job and we love you, we love how you work, blah, blah, blah. All of that stuff felt so good to me because I never got it in my own home. So I became a workaholic. Unbeknownst to me, 7 or 8 years later, my health took a nosedive, and I was diagnosed with lupus at 27 years old, 28 years old almost. My body crashed and burned, literally, because I worked so much for that external validation. I was not taking better care of my physical body. So at some point, all of us, because we're not nurtured at a young enough age through adolescence or into adulthood, at some point as our own independent living adults, we have now engaged in external validation for everyone else to make us feel good about ourselves because we never were taught how to internally feel good about ourselves. No one told us that you are okay as you are. You are lovable and likable as you are because the people that raised us were constantly putting us down. So what about external validation? Has anyone else engaged in that type of behavior?
Oh, yeah. I think that I did it for sure when I got married even. I mean, I wanted to be a part of my husband's family, especially because he would talk so much about how perfect they were. You know, they were always perfect growing up and had the perfect mom and dad and the mom stayed home and, you know, all that stuff. But I know there's something else there. I think I know what it is, but he won't ever tell me. He would never be that vulnerable with me ever. And so, yeah, it's hard to deal with somebody who isn't willing to search internally themselves and give you, you know, that part of them, especially as a partner. you know. If all you've got is just everything seems mechanical, then it doesn't work long term. It worked a lot longer than it probably should have, just from me staying there. So that's, you know, that was the other way that I was hunting for validation. I kept trying to stay in the marriage just so that I could be the good wife and, you know, be the good mom and be the good all of this and make up for it. But on that, then on the same note, I go in, you know, have a surgery, and like I said, he can't be there for me emotionally in any way, or even physically on the same level in the house as me when I have surgeries for some reason. He's got to go watch TV downstairs, and he's only like that when I have surgery. And any other time, he would come up and watch TV with me, but we couldn't.
Can I make out a point to you really quickly? Because, again, this is what I mean by us committed to emotional surgery. You just spoke about him not being there for you as if he's in the present sense.
Right.
Instead of addressing it from the past sense. So you've got to start being aware of the intentions of your emotions when you're describing them. Because as long as you're describing them present sense, he is still very much controlling you, even though you said you all are physically divorced now.
No,
so
we're not.
35 years is a long time to just pack it up and put it in a bag overnight.
Right.
But we've got to become aware of how our emotions are still resonating. He didn't show up for you when you had surgery.
Oh, no.
Not that he doesn't show up for me having surgery. He didn't do it. Past tense. We got to be more intentional about that, and that is putting the distance between you and him. Again, I've never been married, but I have had ex-boyfriends and an ex-fiance. So I've told people, you eventually got to drop that. He is no longer my ex-boyfriend. Just address him by his name, because you still use the word my. The my is the attachment between you and him.
Right.
And even though we can say the word ex-husband, you're still addressing him in the sense of what the husband role was. This person is no longer in your life. This person is the father of your children. He is the grandfather of your grandchildren. You have got to completely switch and change your vernacular when it comes to addressing that person. And it's an exercise like anything else. And once we clearly are able to do it and define it, you're able to put one more step in front of you on that healing process and your healing journey.
Yeah, thank you.
Because if we don't do that, that's still a way in for them. That's still an invitation for them to cross the boundary, because we are still giving them a response to what was a marital or family attachment by calling them my anything. They are no longer my anything. You no longer exist in my life in that role. Your name is Robert, and you are the husband, blah, 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 in past tense. So you are the father of my children, the grandfather of my children. But there is even no further recognition of you being my ex-husband. Like, no, you are my grandkid's grandfather, or you are my children's father. So the my becomes the attachment to the children and no longer to the man. As long as that happens, I'm going to tell you, people don't respect a legal boundary. They could care less about that, because they didn't care about it when you were actually in that role, in that relationship. So in their head, as long as you're using my anything, they are using the word my ex-wife or my whatever, and they still feel that they have an attachment to you. So the behavior is going to continue on. So I just didn't know if you were aware of that or not. But just be really clearly on how you address or even talk about him or bring him up in conversation. You've got to slowly begin to dissect that and sever that. Again, remember, commit to having emotional surgery.
Yeah, I like that. Thank you.
All right, part four on our article here says that you downgrade, dismiss, or hide your feelings or emotions. Perhaps one of the most common signs that you grew up with a narcissistic parent is the tendency to nullify your own feelings and emotions. And again, I think that is tied into the people-pleasing. You are not given the tools, you're not given the freedom to create a self-sense of identity, to create your own value system. Your value and your worth is totally tied into the narcissist. So when you have a strong feeling about something, as we were saying, creating a boundary and being clear in your no, you do have a sense of something, of an affirmation, so to speak, in something you want to happen, in something you're open to happening. That is what the yes means. But the narcissist has begun to place the devaluing and a negative, the negative talk within us, that to a point the negative self-talk comes up, but now we just completely dismiss our own feelings and our own emotions as if they were never really there. So if we have the tendency to dismiss or downgrade or diminish our own feelings, we're doing it again, and we're second-guessing ourselves, and this is where insecurity comes in. We're second-guessing ourselves on everything that we do because of that narcissist constant belittling, put-downs, and devaluing and diminishing and utterly no love that they're able to give us, so we're not able to create reciprocity about it within ourselves. So if any one of us found ourselves where we downgrade or we diminish our own sense of self-value or our own sense of emotions, have any of us ever done that?
I downgrade myself all the time. In my speech, I do.
And it happens on just the simplest of ways. Again, a lot of things that we're not conscious about. But as we grow and hopefully move away from the abusers and the narcissists, we now can see things a little clearer, and we can become more cognizant of our own feelings and thoughts and emotions because they're not constantly being held at the reins by this narcissistic, emotionally abusive person. Now we can clearly say, well, why did I think that? Why did I say that to myself? Why did I feel like that? Because it probably wasn't us that had the initial feeling. It was the residual feelings of the negative implications of the narcissist. All right, let's get to our last point, guys, and we're a few minutes out before wrapping up the call tonight. So the fifth point is, you have a different others. Probably hit home with any of us that have been abused in any way, physically, sexually, emotionally. When the abuse happens and has started for us in childhood, again, we have no sense of non-abusive behaviors because it's environmental. And we're vulnerable. And as children, we don't have the choice to choose our parents or our home environment. So we just are involved in whatever that they show us. So, but when we get to be adults, we have a hard sense of trusting people, and we don't know why. We have a sense of people disappointing us. And I will say that clearly for me in relationships as I got into them as a younger woman and men that I would date. But it was constantly in my head that the relationship is going good. It's great in the beginning, and he's going to do something to disappoint me. He's going to do something to be a failure to me. He's not going to live up to this expectation, to the point that I sabotaged some relationships because I didn't give that person a chance. because I didn't trust them. The reason you didn't trust them, because the trust and the bond of trusting and nurturing was broken at some point in our childhood, because the people who first are supposed to instill a bond of trust and nurturing somehow fractured it or broke it as parents. They put us down. They belittled us. They told us they hated us. They wished we were never born. They hit us. They slapped us. They raped us. They molested us. The trust was broken from the beginning. But when we become adults, we have a problem with trusting people to the point that we will actually self-sabotage some of our relationships because we don't give people a chance to show us that they can be trustworthy. Hit home with some of us. Do we have problems trusting other people?
This is Annie, and I do a lot more than I used to. I used to be a person who immediately loved everyone I met because I just really liked people and I assumed that they can be trusted in every way. But then a lot of bad things happened because I did that. And now it takes a long time for me to trust somebody, and I need to know somebody well and to see them in a lot of different situations to know whether they're trustworthy or not. I don't just give it right away like I used to. So that's where I am. How about Kim?
Oh, yeah. I can relate to it all. I definitely.
And part of that is not letting people in, Annie. As you said, a part of that in our head, it becomes a defense mechanism. But we have to be careful on that because when we talked about the boundaries earlier, right, you can build a wall up so high because you think you're doing it to protect yourself, right? You're trying to keep the bad things out. But if that wall is built so high and it's built a little too sturdy, at some point in time, you're not going to be able to get out of it. So not only will people not be able to come in, you also can't get out of the negative situation and get out of the negative things. Not that the negative people are coming in. We're not able to get out of the negative things that we've built around ourselves that we're thinking when people say that metaphorically, you've got a wall built up. We do it psychologically and emotionally because we're trying to protect ourselves from old abuse that we know for sure that happened because we endured it and we survived it. But we're also now excessively paranoid that other people are going to abuse us and let us down and disappoint us to the point that we don't even give them a chance to show us that they can be trustworthy and loving and nurturing. So we've got to be cognizant in our own behaviors and our own thoughts, intentional in our own words and behaviors and thoughts. We've got to get on the journey to healing and loving ourselves, and you would eventually be able to manifest a healing and loving and nurturing relationship with other people.
So much. This has been so informative, just everything that you've told us. Tell us real quick, because you've only got, 35 seconds, how we can get a hold of you.
You can reach me on confessionsblog2019@gmail.com. That's my email. Or you can text me, 678-632-1098. And right now, my current Instagram address is Miss B. The Teacher, MSBTHATEACHER. That is via Instagram. So thanks, everyone, for having me on, and I will be on the fourth Thursday of next month as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Monica, for being here. Thank you, Kim, for being here. And thank you, for Darlene, for being here as well. And that's all the time we have. Thank you, everybody. See you tomorrow night.
Good night, everyone. Good night.
Good night.